It's 5:06 and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up in just a few minutes, we'll talk to Mark Frauenfelder of Make Magazine and Boing Boing about the maker movement and maker fairs around the country.
But first, we have an audio postcard from WPR reporter Mike Simonson.
A few dozen bikers got together recently in a small southern Ashland County town to rev their engines and go for a day's ride. They're members of ABATE, a national motorcyclist rights group. They talked to Mike before they took off from Cayuga for a long Northwoods ride.
Zed Williams. I'm from Highbridge, Wisconsin. We're a motorcycle safety and rights organization. Our primary goal is to protect riders' rights. We don't want government intrusion in places where it doesn't belong, which includes trying to tell us what to ride, how to ride.
Hi, I'm Jenny Williams. I'm from Highbridge, Wisconsin. Yes, women like biking just as much as the guys. There's a lot of us that have our own motorcycles. There's, I'm going to say, probably, maybe not half the members of ABATE are women, but there certainly is a good portion. ABATE of Wisconsin is working for motorcyclist rights, and we really want to have a little more participation from all the other motorcyclists out there, because we're looking out for their interests. They ride free because of me. So.
Are people scared of you when you guys are in packs?
I hope not, but some probably still are. The old stereotypes die hard. People like myself, I mean, I haven't seen a barber or a shave in 35 years, but that's my choice. It really doesn't have anything to do with riding motorcycles. But unfortunately, people have a tendency to stereotype us. But after all these years, you certainly wouldn't think that that should matter anymore, would you?
I'm Ron Schlins. I'm from Mellon, Wisconsin. People look at motorcyclists as some sort of an outlaw or something, but we're not. We're just professional people. We love to ride bikes and be out in the wind and get some bugs in the teeth. You know what I'm saying, Dave?
It's also a brother and a sisterhood, you know. Just the fact that you swing a leg over a bike and ride down the road when you stop at gas stations, restaurants, bars, whatever, there's always somebody that enjoys what we do as well.
It's true that there's a blind spot. You might try that sometime. When you're looking left and you're looking right, there's a blind spot that you don't see. So you should always look twice. Not just once, but twice.
I'm Kent Werner. I'm from Superior, Wisconsin. I think we're too small, and we're a little bit faster. We appear quicker, and people don't pay attention when they drive. I've seen people with dogs on their laps, eating their sandwiches, putting on their makeup, talking on the phone, texting, messing with their kids in the back seat. There's just too many things going on, and it only takes 1 second to put a biker down.
Got to watch out for Mother Nature. Deer, possums, skunks. I'm Lynn, and I'm from Hurley. I have my own bike. My boyfriend has his own bike. And we brought the son-in-law and the daughter-in-law out, and they're on a bike for the first time. It's not all about men. Women ride, too.
I love the wind. I love getting out there. I have to admit, I love the power of the motorcycle under me. I own my own. I like having a good time. It's just a real free feeling. Something to do, places to go, people to meet.
The sights are easier to see. You're out in nature, whether it's a beautiful sunny day or whether it's rain and snow and sleet and cold, you still enjoy the ride. It's all about the ride.
It's just the freedom, having the wind and not having a great big cage around you. It's just the freedom of the road. There's nothing like it. If you haven't done it, there's nothing like it.
Hey, we're going to head up. We're going to head up towards Ashland and then over to Saxon.
Thanks to our reporter, Mike Simonson, for filing that audio postcard. He tells us the bikers ended their day back in Cayuga for some supper at the local inn, a bonfire, and some live music.
The Maker Faire takes place in Detroit this weekend. That's as close as the action ever gets to Wisconsin, but there's still a lot of interest in the growing maker movement here in the state.
Mark Frauenfelder joins us now. He's editor-in-chief of Make Magazine, co-editor of the weblog Boing Boing. His books include Made by Hand, Adventures in the World of Do-It-Yourself. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot.
Now, we mentioned the Maker Faires coming up. These go on all around the country, not here in Wisconsin, not yet anyway. What happens at a Maker Faire?
Maker Faires are these places where hundreds and sometimes over 100,000 people congregate to find out what people are making in their basements and garages and backyards, all kinds of projects. There are high-tech, low-tech robots, rockets, remote control things, electronics projects, kinetic toys. It's like a giant-sized science fair that people of all ages participate in.
Mark, why do you think we're seeing a growing interest in making stuff right now? Why is it so hot?
I think one of the big reasons is because so much of our lives are devoted to computers and screens and mobile devices and then video games and things like that. People want to touch the real world and use their hands to look at the world as kind of the ultimate hackable platform and get away from sitting at a desk, get outside, make things, go into their garage, and especially hook up with other people who are interested in the same thing. Making has turned out to be like a really great group activity, and there's all sorts of clubs that are forming all over the world called maker spaces or hacker spaces where people meet after work or on the weekend, and they get together and they make cool things together.
I have this sense of this generational shift. I'm probably not alone. My grandparents could do anything. My parents could do a lot of stuff. I can't do anything. I'm like the worst hands-on person. I'm one of those people who I don't do a project at home because I know something bad will happen and it'll cost more than it would have just to hire someone in the first place. Is there a sense that we have something lost that we're trying to get back?
I think so. And I think what our grandparents knew and realized that we're just starting to rediscover is that when you have some control over the world around you, your immediate world, your house, your family, your neighborhood, and you can affect changes in that kind of small sphere, the sense of reward and fulfillment you get from that is really powerful, even if it's something as simple as gardening food and making your own sauerkraut or preserves, or keeping chickens in your backyard, or keeping bees like I do. Having a little bit of control over some of the things in your world rather than relying on systems all around you to provide those things you need is a fantastic feeling, and it's a great way to live your life.
Mark, you're kind of one of the high priests of the maker movement right now, but how did you get into it?
My parents were actually big makers and crafters. My dad was an electrical engineer, and in addition to doing all sorts of home electronics projects, Heathkit radios and making all sorts of electronic contraptions, he also made his own leather clothing and stained glass windows. And so that kind of hanging around with them when I was younger influenced me indirectly. I feel like it was kind of a decades-long incubation experience. I always remembered what they did, and after I gravitated towards computers and do-it-yourself media and making my own records and things like that. But in probably the last 10 years or so, I started to really think about all the fun things that we had done as a family when I was younger, and I have daughters myself, so I started getting back into it, and it's been really fun ever since we started doing it.
We've got Mark Frauenfelder of Make Magazine with us. Coming up soon, we're going to ask him for some suggestions for people like, well, maybe you, but definitely me, maybe a little intimidated by getting into making something, a good way to start. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you like to make stuff? What's your favorite kind of project? Did you take on something new that was maybe a little outside of your comfort zone? Whether it's growing or processing your own food or something high-tech or in between, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation now with Mark Frauenfelder, editor-in-chief of Make Magazine and co-editor of BoingBoing.com, getting inspired about making things and getting a whiff of the maker movement, which is getting pretty strong right now, this movement of people who like to get their hands in there and make things for fun and also just to tinker with things. Lots of great projects, and we're going to hear about some in a little bit and also hear from you.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 or go to the Central Time Facebook page. Tell us something you've made recently that you're proud of, a quilt, a machine, a kit project, you name it. 800-642-1234 or go to the Central Time Facebook page. Mark, give us a taste of a project, something that the inept among us like me might dip our toes in the water of the maker movement with.
Sure. I think that what you do is you start with modest goals, and then you slowly challenge yourself once you master skills. So one thing that I like is music, playing guitar and things like that. I've always thought it would be fun to make my own guitar. That's really hard to do. You need special tools to do it. So instead, I started making cigar box guitars, using a cigar box as the body and then a piece of oak wood for the neck. It doesn't require specialized tools. I was intimidated about installing frets in the neck, so I found out that you could use toothpicks instead of metal frets and glue them on. And so I put it together expecting it to sound horrible. And when I strung it up and tuned it and played it, I was shocked that it sounded half decent. I started falling in love with making cigar box guitars, and I've probably made at least a dozen now. I make them, give them away as presents. I've made cigar box ukuleles, and now I have bought a couple of books on making actual normal-looking ukuleles and guitars, and that's probably my next project is to do that now that I've learned how to install metal frets. So I think one thing is to start small. The other thing is to do something that you really are passionate and interested about. If you like skateboarding, try making a skateboard. It's not really that hard to do. You just take some pieces of plywood, thin plywood, glue them together, clamp them together, cut it out into a shape, and you've got a skateboard body, and then you just screw the trucks on, install the wheels, and start rolling away.
Excellent. Well, so place to start for sure. Those cigar box guitars sound like they're pretty cool. Let's go first to Michael in Appleton from our callers. Hi, Michael.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm doing well. This is a really interesting conversation so far, and I'm really enjoying the new show, for one.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, and just one small thing I did sort of for my daughter. There's a cartoon called Adventure Time. It's on Cartoon Network, and I pretty recently picked up a cheap lamp from a thrift store and took everything that was on there off and built a frame around it to make a lamp of a character from the show. So that was fun. I just used some wood and craft supplies.
Nice.
But then it's sort of a bigger thing for me is being into punk music and the punk scene. And, I mean, Appleton has a weirdly big punk scene for a relatively small city. And there's, I found through the years, you know, there's a very strong DIY mentality amongst people who are into punk music. People will, I mean, back in the day, people would press their own vinyls, and now they make their own CDs, and I know friends who just have small recording units in their houses and T-shirts and merchandise, and I personally, I haven't played in a band myself for a while now, but I've made studded clothing just...
Huh.
I have a studded leather jacket and a studded denim vest, and I actually I have one in my car right now I'm working on for my 5-year-old daughter.
All right. Well, I've got to ask, Mark, before I let you go, did your daughter like your Adventure Time lamp? Did she like the Adventure Time lamp?
Yeah, she loves it. And I made the face so the light bulb lights up Bemo's face, so he turns on because he's a little computer.
Michael, thank you so much for calling. And Mark, I wanted to get your follow-up. I mean, he was talking about the punk scene and the do-it-yourself. It seems like the maker movement has that sort of do-it-yourself punk ethos that we saw a lot in the 80s and 90s.
Oh, definitely. I mean, that's kind of the world that I came from. I was in a rockabilly punk band in the 80s, and I produced my own zine. Boing Boing, the website I do, started out as a print zine in the 80s. And I think a lot of this kind of do-it-yourself ethos came from that. It was people who, especially punk rock, they wanted to short-circuit the music industry because it was so hard to break into the music industry unless you were a super group. So they just went out and pressed their own records, booked their own tours, made their own T-shirts, and just did it. And I think that kind of mindset of just being able to, you know, let's just do it, and we'll learn as we go along. That's really what the whole make ethos is about. Makers aren't afraid of mistakes. Mistakes teach them and propel them to move forward and encourage them to be creative. You know, too many people equate mistakes with failure. Mistakes don't mean failure unless you give up.
Now, Mark, we know that there's a bit of this punk rock ethos in making stuff, but I'm curious, too, are women involved in this movement as well, as heavily as the men are?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Tons of women are involved, and I, in fact, see a large percentage of women have taken making to a professional level and have made it their livelihood. And I'm thinking of people like Lamore Freed, who started a company called Adafruit Industries, and she sells electronic kits, and she's very successful and has a huge fan base, does a video every week called Ask an Engineer, and she talks about teaching people electronics. And then another woman, Aya Badir, started a company called Little Bits, and it's an electronics kit for kids where you just snap together components. They connect magnetically, and you can make all sorts of really cool things out of these little snap-together components. So women are a huge part of this, we have lots of women on staff at Make Magazine, too. It's a very inclusive world.
We'll go back to the phones now. Thanks for the call, Michael. We've got Mark now in Milwaukee. Hi, Mark.
Hi. How are you doing?
Good, good. What did you think of, or what are you making?
Well, I am a member of the Milwaukee Makerspace. I wanted to let everybody know there is such a thing, and we have a website that's milwaukeemakerspace.org, and let's see, I have built a 3D printer there, among other smaller projects, and
wow.
we have a 16,000 square foot building that's just us, and we've got a machine shop, metal shop. We've got a craft area with embroidery machines and sewing machines. We've got laser cutters. I don't know, you name it. Welding equipment. We've got a kiln. We've got a couple of forges. We've got an electronics area. And we got tons and tons of, you know, parts and equipment and all kinds of stuff.
Gotcha, Mark. I'm Mark Fraunfelder. I want to get you in and talk a little bit about these makerspaces or hackerspaces, they call them both names. How important are those these days?
They're really important. I think that they're basically like clubs where people pay between $30 to $100 a month to pay rent on this place, get insurance, buy things like laser cutters and 3D printers and soldering workstations. And all of that's great because it's a place to go, and if you're living in a smaller apartment or something like that, or you can't afford to have a workshop, this is a place where you can do all that. But most importantly, it's a place where you can meet up with other people who like to make things. And so the cross-pollination is amazing. You'll find someone who's really good at using microcontrollers, and then someone else is really good at mechanisms, and someone else might be really good at sewing. And so you can make a robot that's got felt skin on it that moves around and does some kind of a task or something. People are getting together and sharing their skills, and that's like the true killer app of the maker movement is other makers.
Well, Mark, we're getting short on time here, a little bit less than a minute, but can you give us any final words of inspiration just to get out there and start trying stuff when you're like Rob and maybe like me and you're a little afraid of messing it up?
Yeah, I think that was my stumbling block, too, was being afraid of messing up. Don't be afraid to mess up. You're going to make mistakes. You should always try not to make mistakes, but you have to keep in mind that you are going to make mistakes, and you'll make a lot of mistakes, but you're going to learn from them. And the amazing thing that I found out about making mistakes is it often points you in a direction you never thought of going in, and you'll come up with some really great ideas that you otherwise wouldn't have thought of. And it's better to make mistakes when you do something than not to, because you'll always end up with something a lot cooler.
Excellent. Well, I think we're going to try. We'll see what happens.
Great.
Mark Frauenfelder, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Robin, Veronica.
I'm talking with Mark Frauenfelder, editor-in-chief of Make Magazine and co-editor of BoingBoing.com.
All right, I'm going to re-resolve to do some kind of project with my daughters. I'll keep it simple. Maybe a kit or something. Veronica, are you going to try something with the kids?
Something. I got to think about what it's going to be.
I know.
The guitar sounds pretty cool.
Yeah, maybe I'll check that one out.
All right.
Coming up in a few moments, another piece in the puzzle of bee colony collapses. I'm Rob Ferret.
I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's Food Friday, and we're talking about an American favorite, mac and cheese.
First, though, a new study has some answers that may point the way to why so many bees are dying in what's come to be known as bee colony collapse. The study was published in PLOS-1, getting a lot of media attention today, and we've got one of the researchers with us. Dennis von Engelsdorp from the Department of Entomology at the University of Maryland. Dennis, thanks for joining us.
I appreciate your interest.
Well, a lot of people are interested in this. This bee colony collapse is a big mystery, and it's a big deal. Talk about what's at stake here before we get into your research.
Well, honeybees pollinate one in every three bites of food we eat. So most of the honeybees in the colony, at least half of the colonies in the country, move up and down the coast or across the country to pollinate various fruit and vegetable crops. And so we need them if we want to continue to produce fruits and vegetables and nuts in the country.
What's new about your findings that we're seeing this week?
Well, what we did in this study was we collected pollen from colonies as they were being used to pollinate different crops, seven different crops in all. And then we took that pollen and analyzed some of it for pesticides. And we found large numbers of pesticides, as many as 21 different pesticides, and on average 9 different pesticides in each pollen sample. And then we fed that pollen, some of that remaining pollen, to bees and exposed those bees to a common bee disease. And we found, and what really surprised us, was that there was a lot of fungicides in this in the pollen, and that the bees exposed to this pollen with fungicides were much more likely to come down with disease. And that was surprising because we don't usually think of fungicides as having a high risk for bees.
In a way, this isn't an easy, simple explanation. Probably, I imagine there was some hope that you'd find the one chemical or the one disease that was causing bee colony collapse, and that would be really easy to deal with. That's not what we're seeing, is it?
Well, that's exactly right. And we don't actually think that fungicides are the solution. And what we're moving towards, and I think there's a consensus building, that the reason we're losing so many colonies a year, on average 30% every winter for the last 6 winters, is a combination of factors. Poor nutrition, and increasingly we're seeing millions of acres being plowed under that used to be meadows to plant corn and soybean in the Midwest. So poor nutrition, we're seeing pesticides, both the pesticides beekeepers are having to apply to their colonies to keep them healthy, and also farmer-applied pesticides, and, of course, the pathogens, most notably varroa mite, which are these large vampire-like mites that feed on the blood of bees and also pass on viruses. And so we think it's a combination of all three of those that work together. And so this is an excellent example where we have two factors coming together. We have fungicides sort of predisposing the bees so that they're more likely to get a common bee disease.
Where are the bees picking up this fungicide? Is it just from crops?
Well, we did this study exactly for just crops. We were looking at different crops. And it's not surprising we found fungicides so much because, of course, there are no rules against the use of fungicides on flowering plants when bees are foraging. There are rules against using insecticides that kill insects while bees are foraging, but nothing for fungicides because fungicides don't kill bees directly. And so we're seeing a lot of this in the pollen from agricultural crops. It is an open question about whether we would find this in non-agricultural regions. That brings up a good point, is that it's important to realize that backyard gardeners use many more times the amount of pesticides per acre than farmers do. And so it's likely that we would pick up a lot of these pesticides in the urban environment as well.
Are we at a point now where we can say, here are some changes we need to make to help stop the decline of bee populations, maybe help start regrowing those populations?
Well, I think that that's a really good point, and I think that it's important to remember that there's probably a lot of different factors that have to be used to help keep pollinators healthy. This certainly points to something that we can do immediately, and that is beekeepers can work with farmers and ask the farmers, who of course aren't interested in killing bees, to think about not spraying their crop while the bees are foraging on their crop. And that seems like a very straightforward and simple answer. Will that eliminate all the losses in the country? Absolutely not. But it seems like a very concrete step in the right direction.
To not spray with the fungicides in particular.
While the bees are foraging on those crops, right.
We've seen in Europe bans of particular types of chemicals, nicotinoids, I think, if I'm saying it right.
Right.
Is that just too simplistic a response, do you think?
Well, I think that certainly there's been a lot of attention on neonicotinoids. They're a class of insecticides. We didn't find many of these that chemical in any of the sampling we did. We only actually found it in apple pollen when we collected from apple orchards. So I don't think it's the silver bullet. I don't think that by banning neonics we'll see an improvement in bee health. Or a large-scale improvement in bee health. I think we have to approach this with a lot of different ways of making sure bees are healthy. And so that's making sure they have enough forage that they can eat on, and collect good, clean pollen from. Making sure that we're reducing pesticide exposure in general, and making sure that the bees are disease-free.
And you mentioned earlier a lack of nutrition for the bees. This is because they just don't have as much area to forage in anymore?
Well, that's right. With the price of corn and soybean, a lot of land that was left fallow and allowed meadows to grow in the conservation programs have been plowed under to grow corn and soybean. So those traditional summer grounds for a lot of the bees in the country in the Midwest are now a lot of corn and soybean. And, of course, that doesn't produce much nutrition for bees at all. And so I think that there are practical things we can do that is, like, why do we mow the sides of our highways and byways? Could we grow pollinator-friendly plants there to supplement bee nutrition? And so I think that there are a lot of interesting and intriguing ways that we can improve bee health if we put a concerted, multi-pronged effort to tackle this problem.
Dennis, you're on the front line of researching this problem. It sounds like you are hopeful that even though it's complicated, even though there's a lot going into it, we can turn this around?
I certainly do think it's hopeful. My big worry is that we're going to lose a lot of commercial beekeepers while we're trying to do that. And so it's important to remember that half the colonies in the country move up and down the coast, and they're owned by relatively few beekeepers. And these beekeepers have lost 30% of their colonies or better every year for the last 6 years. And that's really hard to sustain. You can't do that, even though you can replace those colonies fairly easily. You can't afford to do that for very long. And so I think that there are a lot of commercial beekeepers who are not doing this anymore because it makes good business sense, but because they love keeping bees. And I think I and a lot of people are worried that these guys are going out of business. And that, of course, will not only affect them and their families, it'll affect the almond producer, the blueberry producer in Maine, the apple producer in Pennsylvania, the cucumber producer in New Jersey, and a whole host of other farmers relying on those same colonies to pollinate those crops.
Do you think the message is getting out there to the public, to policymakers, to people in the agricultural industry, how darn important the bees are?
I certainly hope so, and I think that that may be one of the silver bullets here, is because before we had this large-scale collapse that we documented in 2006 and 2007, we had lost over 50% of the colonies in this country over the last 50 years, and no one was paying attention to that. I think that these sudden dramatic declines has drawn the attention of the public and policymakers to the importance of bees. And so hopefully we can get a lot of groups together to help solve this. And certainly there's a lot more action in government and certainly a lot more people aware of the problem and trying to do something to help.
Dennis, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I appreciate your interest.
That was Dennis Van Engelsdorp. He's assistant research scientist in the Department of Entomology at the University of Maryland.
Now we'll check the headlines, and then it's Food Friday. We'll indulge in a gooey American staple, mac and cheese. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Let's face it, if you're craving some comfort food, there's a pretty good chance you've got macaroni and cheese on your mind.
It's the classic childhood dish. It's a big hit with my kids still, and I'll eat it with them. It still appeals to me. While the traditional mac and cheese is great, sometimes it's nice to spice things up, and our next guest has done just that.
Aaron Wade is the co-author of the Mac and Cheese Cookbook, 50 Simple Recipes from Homeroom, America's favorite mac and cheese restaurant. Aaron, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, what is it about mac and cheese? Why do you think it's one of these perennial comfort foods that we never really outgrow?
You know, I think that the beauty of it is that it really just, it satisfies every kind of craving you could have. You know, there's the richness of the cream sauce. There's sort of the saltiness of the cheese. I think there's just something primal about carbohydrates, and so you've got the noodles. And so it's just sort of this perfect package, you know, that it's just hard to ever get enough.
And you opened a restaurant specializing in mac and cheese. That sounds like a gamble. Are there enough people out there who want to get that mac and cheese and not just make it at home?
Well, you know, it's so funny. When me and my business partner, Allison, decided to open the restaurant 2.5 years ago, people thought we were nuts. I mean, they absolutely didn't think so. And we got a lot of, like, are you going to serve burgers there? Like, aren't you going to have, you know, pizza? Like, won't you do other things? We're like, no, like, there's burger places, there's pizza places. Why on earth is there not a mac and cheese place? And so we knew it was a huge gamble. It was either going to fall on its face or be, like, insanely successful. And luckily, we've been packed since the day we were open, and people are just obsessed with it and love it. So we feel really fortunate, and it's definitely a gamble that paid off for us.
Do you think that people come in for mac and cheese when they need sort of an emotional pick-me-up, or is it just all-around good comfort food?
You know, I think the thing that's been most amazing to us is that, you know, I mean, we're located in Oakland, California, which is a fairly diverse city, and we weren't really sure, you know, who was going to come. And it really is just amazing. You know, it's kids, it's adults, it's, you know, old people, it's young people, it's, you know, Asian, black, white. It's amazing how it's just this universally loved food, you know, sort of like ice cream or, you know, coffee. It's one of these things that just really speaks to people.
You've got a base recipe that goes into the dishes you make. Can you tell us what it is? What are the key ingredients to any good mac and cheese?
Sure. So it's basically the base sauce. We call it mac sauce, but it's bechamel sauce is what the French would call it. A lot of people are intimidated by it, but it's really actually pretty easy. All it is butter, flour, milk, and a little bit of salt. And it sort of, it's your basic, you know, creamy white sauce. And then to that, you can make all sorts of crazy permutations. You know, you can add whatever cheeses, whatever toppings, and so, you know, we spent a lot of time in the cookbook teaching people how to make it, having troubleshooting advice, because really once you've mastered it, there's nothing else that's even a little bit challenging about making mac and cheese.
So let's talk about that cheese. Now, we're in Wisconsin here. We know our cheeses. How much does the cheese that you put in matter? Do you want to go out there and get that beautiful aged Gouda?
So, you know, it was really interesting for us. When we got the offer to write the cookbook, we were so excited because, you know, at the restaurant, we really try to focus on making mac and cheese very affordable and approachable. So we don't have anything on our menu that's over $10, and we try to buy the best cheeses possible within those parameters. And, you know, we thought that when we were writing the cookbook, we were going to be able to buy all these crazy cheeses that we love to eat at home and we'll put on fancy cheese plates. And, you know, when we started experimenting with them, we actually found that they really were not good in mac and cheese, that mac and cheese is a food that should not be gussied up too much. And, you know, I would say you're still often better off getting, you know, you're going to have more flavor in an aged cheese, but really up to a point, you know. So a supermarket cheddar that's been aged a year, that's going to work great in mac and cheese. You know, a British farmstead cheddar that might have been aged for a few years and, you know, it's cloth-bound and all that, it honestly isn't as delicious. It ends up having sort of overkill on these very intense flavors. So I think that, honestly, that's a great thing. Wisconsin's got, you know, like California, has a ton of amazing, you know, local cheeses that you could use. But I would say, you know, there's no need to break the bank at mac and cheese.
So if we're not getting too funky with our cheese, what are some ways, if we want to, you know, serve mac and cheese to some friends, we'll want to make it look like we did something a little fancier, how can we gussy it up in an appropriate way?
Well, you know, I would say if you do want to use fancy cheeses, one of the tricks that we use is it's very easy to have overkill of those flavors. So you can use a little bit, like we do a blue cheese mac that actually is only a quarter blue cheese and the rest of it is jack cheese, just to create sort of a creaminess for the texture, but you get the pungency of the blue cheese. So I'm not saying don't ever use fancy cheeses, but certainly don't use them in the quantities that you might other types of cheese. And, you know, other ways are really with, you know, sort of the toppings and the add-ins. You know, at the restaurant, you know, at home room, we do everything from, you know, sautéed mushrooms and garlic to a compound ginger butter that we put in an Asian-style one. So, you know, there's really almost any ingredient you can think of, you can usually find a way to make it absolutely delicious in mac and cheese. So if you love truffles, like throw in some truffle salt or, you know, shave some truffles in or use a truffle cheese. Or like I said, if there are certain herbs that you like, we find that they tend to be best not thrown in by themselves, but to make a compound butter, which is basically where you just take herbs, mash it up in butter, and then add that to the mac, and it makes it rich and creamy and has the flavor of, you know, tarragon or whatever you'd like to add. So,
well,
yeah,
so
I would say overall, just, you know, if you have favorite flavors, experiment with them, with the cheeses you like, because it usually will work out.
So if we're not getting too crazy with the cheeses there, you do have, you know, on the other end of the spectrum, you've got one, I think it's called Trailer Park Mac and Cheese. It looks kind of like the cheese that you spell with a Z. It doesn't really, you know, look like your finest aged cheddar, but it looks pretty darn good. Tell us about that one.
Sure. So our trailer mac actually was invented because when we were opening homeroom, we just sort of started asking people around, you know, what are your favorite things to put into mac and cheese? And two of the most common responses were hot dogs and potato chips. So we decided to create the trailer mac, which was both those things. And we actually weren't super sure that was going to be delicious, but it has actually turned into a very beloved part of our menu that we've never taken off. And we use a really high-quality hot dog from Nyman Ranch, and we use a great 18-month cheddar. And so I guess it's, you know, I guess it's a bit of an ironic dish that we use all these nice things, but we call it trailer mac.
How come the cheese looks so melty? It doesn't look like I think of, you know, when you're talking about aged Vermont cheddar, it looks really like, you know, kind of like Velveeta. How do you get that texture?
So, you know, that's really about the mac sauce. And getting a really creamy base that you're adding the cheese to. Because if you have a creamy, silky base, that cheese is going to melt into it really beautifully. And if you don't, then you won't.
We've got one of the recipes from your book posted on our Central Time Facebook page, and I've got to ask you about it. I guess mac and cheese isn't just for dinner anymore. You've got a breakfast mac. Tell us about that.
Sure. Well, in that mac, we basically... Something that we actually did throughout the cookbook and that we do at the restaurant as well is we love sort of deconstructing our favorite dishes that are not related to mac and cheese and making them mac and cheese. So the breakfast mac was one of those where we thought about, we love breakfast sandwiches, and we were like, what can we serve during brunch on the weekends? And so we add, we cook bacon into it and fry an egg and throw it on top, and we also, we bake it off in the oven so it's got sort of a crunchy topping. So, you know, it's sort of mimicking a breakfast sandwich. We also did a shepherd's mac in the cookbook, which we love shepherd's pie, and we were like, oh, you know, the only thing that can make shepherd's pie more delicious is if
instead of the mashed potatoes, you had mac and cheese. So we did that, where we deconstructed shepherd's pie and then reconstructed it with mac and cheese instead of potatoes. And that turned out to be actually one of our favorite creations, too.
So what is the craziest thing that you've tried to do with macaroni and cheese? Maybe one that maybe didn't make it onto the restaurant menu, but you guys were a little bored one night and you wanted to go for it.
Oh, God. You know, I'd say the biggest challenge that we had and the greatest number of failures we have ever experienced in recipe testing was in trying to invent an Asian mac. Because, you know, we call it like the international relations section of the cookbook, where it's all recipes that feature, you know, international cheeses and things like that. So we were trying to think of something for Asia. But, you know, traditionally, cheese is not in any Asian countries. It's not an Asian staple. And so trying to figure out how to incorporate, you know, Asian flavors and make them work with dairy products and mac and cheese was really tough. And we made, like, one with, like, a sweet and sour pork, and it was just really disgusting. I mean, we really tried all sorts of things. We ended up luckily coming up with one that is really delicious, which ironically uses sriracha, which is made in Los Angeles and not even in Thailand. It has a ginger butter, scallions, Havarti, and sriracha, the Red Rooster hot sauce. And that is incredible, but it took a long, long time.
Wow. Well, so much to try from. Erin, thank you so much for helping us get inspired about mac and cheese.
Yeah, thanks so much for getting contact. And, you know, we're so excited to get to chat with some folks from another cheese-loving state. So.
Great. Well, thanks a lot. Erin Wade is co-author of the Mac and Cheese Cookbook.
Coming up Monday on Central Time, we'll be talking with NPR's ombudsman. He'll address concerns that NPR has a regional bias and wonder if it's time to move NPR to the Midwest.
We'll also look at a growing trend of giving employees unlimited vacation. That's coming up Monday on Central Time. Coming up after the news, it's the 25th anniversary of Sub Pop, the studio that most notably signed Nirvana and went on to introduce us to the music of artists like The Shins, Iron and Wine, and the Postal Service. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.